Welcome to June 2014 Functional Medicine Update. This is the third in a series of what I would call foundations of functional medicine. And we're very pleased that this month we have an individual who I have a long and rich history with, Dr. Kenneth Pelletier. Dr. Pelletier is going to really help extend this functional medicine systems biology model from that of the individual to that of the workplace environment. That is, to a broader model where hopefully more people can be influenced in a positive way as it pertains to how to access this systems biology thinking. And as you probably know, Dr. Pelletier was the author of a book that was, for me, very transformative when I was a professor at Evergreen State College. And we actually used his book, Mind is Healer, Mind is Slayer, as a very important part of the curriculum of the course that I was teaching, which was really the presaging for me of my thinking about functional medicine. So I'd have to say that Dr. Pelletier's book and his concepts of the mind is healer, mind is slayer as a systems thinking model, and then moving into Dr. Freeze and his work, and then, of course, later my knowledge of Dr. Leroy Hood's work as it relates to his concept of systems biology. Those three together framed an important foundation and cornerstone of what gave birth to the concept of functional medicine back in 1990. So with that in mind, we're really pleased to have Dr. Pelletier tell us about this history that he has been involved in as a principal in really opening up the construct of how these concepts can be applied both institutionally and organizationally to affect millions of lives. So with that, let's move to our discussion with Dr. Pelletier. Well, here we are once again at certainly my favorite part of Functional Medicine Update. That's our Clinician or Researcher of the Month section, which we really use to frame each of these months' issue. And we're very, very fortunate, and I personally feel extraordinarily fortunate to have an individual that I think can give us both a historical context of the evolution and development of the field that we all share and also a forward-looking vision tender as to where this field is going. And I'm speaking to a colleague and friend who has actually been a mentor of mine and a great figure of my own education, and that's Dr. Kenneth Pelletier. Some of you probably go back, as I do, to the 1970s and what was his absolutely frame-shifting book called Mind is Healer, Mind is Slayer that I believe really gave birth to the field of psychoneuroimmunology and this whole burgeoning concept of the body as a web and as a network rather than as a collection of piece parts of organ systems. And that was really a step in understanding of the new biology of the 21st century that presaged it by more than 20 years. And it was the textbook and a number of courses that I used in the university that I was teaching. I taught literally thousands of medical students using that as a book. And Dr. Pelletier has gone on and just done extraordinary things. So let me give you a couple of vignettes of his extraordinary background. Presently, he's a clinical professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine and Family and Community Medicine at the University of Arizona School of Medicine. And he also has adjunct activities at the Department of Psychiatry, University of California School of Medicine, San Francisco. He was previously at Stanford. He's worked with UCLA and corporate health areas with Jonathan Fielding, who was another colleague that I had the fortune of knowing back in the 80s. His work on corporate health promotion and integrated systems of healthcare are truly pioneering, and he probably has more feet-on-the-street experience in how to implement integrated health systems into corporate environments than anybody that I'm aware of that's presently living or maybe has ever lived. And his ability to take divergent information and distill it down, integrate it together, and then find institutional places for it to be implemented, I think is truly unique in our field. He's also an active scholar and published more than 50 papers in the peer-reviewed literature over the years that have really codified and, I think, defined the nature of this domain of corporate health promotion from an integrated perspective. And he's been able to bring so many of these principles that we now consider new that are really, to Dr. Pelletier, old principles that he pioneered that have now become new in the minds of many who are just learning them and starting to implement them successfully into systems that really, I believe, are going to improve cost effectiveness of healthcare and help us beat back this rising tide of chronic illness. So, Ken, it's just so wonderful to have you as a Functional Medicine Update contributor, and
I could say so many other laudatory things about your background, but I hope I've at least given a sense as the domain and scope and breadth of your contributions over the years. So welcome to FMU.
Thank you very much, and thank you for those kind words. I would reciprocate with my admiration for your work, which I've followed for many years as well. So this is actually quite fun. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Let's start back at the Mind Healer, Mind Slayer level. What led you into writing that book and really creating what I think has become a major discipline? What was the kind of presaging things that led you into that?
There are really two things. One was a personal experience, the other was professional. The personal experience was that I had spent some time in Greece and North Africa and Europe and the Near East traveling and just hiking around. It was the time in the 70s to do that. And I happened to end up on an island in Greece named Tinos. And on Tinos, there is a small chapel that is the equivalent for the Greek Orthodox religion of Lourdes in the French tradition, a place of miracles. And I was there when there were pilgrimages taking place to that chapel. And at the time, I saw things that to me made no sense. People that were in extreme pain and would pray and enter the chapel would come out and they'd be walking and moving seemingly without pain with greater limb movement, skin conditions that would clear. I didn't see miraculous regenerations of limbs, but I saw enough that violated everything I had been taught about how our physiology was supposed to react. And I began to think that what was the role of belief? What had modified their ability to believe in themselves and believe what was possible to make these changes? So that was my personal experience and personal question. I came back to UCSF School of Medicine, and at that time, Dr. Joe Kamiya was doing really the pioneering research in clinical biofeedback. And at that time, there was a controversy about whether or not a human person could control their own sympathetic nervous system, their own autonomic nervous system. I had read about some research that Elmer Green had conducted at the Menninger Clinic with several adept meditators who were capable of controlling bleeding, pain, infection, but it had been done in a non-controlled way. It was really anecdotal. So in Joe's lab at UCSF, I set up the first structured studies where we looked at a series of adept meditators, in particular a man named Jack Schwartz, who was a Dutch survivor of a Nazi concentration camp, who did a very unique thing of puncturing his bicep with a sharpened knitting needle and not bleeding, not experiencing pain, not having any infection from an unsterilized needle. And we documented his ability to do this and made it very clear that we are able to regulate our own autonomic nervous system. So the two events together made me really start to think about how powerful is the influence of the mind on our physiology. And the last thing I would add is it's not a matter of mind over matter. That's not the issue. My focus is that mind does matter, that it's a critical variable in determining our health and states of illness.
Yeah, I would say the impact that your book had on me when I picked it up was one of those great aha experiences. I bet this was a general reaction that literally tens of thousands of other readers had as well, and that is you, for the first time, really started to help me understand the system that we later call systems biology and integrated systems, that there is no this division like angels on the head of the pin. There is this interactive system, which I think later got codified into terms like psychoneuroimmunology, and where we have these integrated web-like interactions. And your book did an absolutely fantastic job of introducing that concept, and I think set forward this movement that we've seen over the last 35 or more years that has become the medicine of the 21st century.
I would agree with that. One of the interesting things about Mind is Healer, Mind is Slayer, set one, it's still in print, and I'm always amazed at that. But in 1992, Dell Publishing decided to publish an updated anniversary edition of the book, and they sent it out to reviewers, and they asked, should we update the text, or should we leave it as is and just have a new foreword? And the overwhelming response back was, leave it as it is, because it really did create the template. And we actually, even in the book, used the term psychoneuroimmunology way before it was in widespread use, but it was a way to try to describe this systemic linkage between mind and body, between mental states and physiology states, and also subtle energy systems. So we just had an updated forward to the book in 1992. And to me, what was fascinating is when I had to go back into the book and write this update on the forward, I realized that the science had progressed. Our understanding of the nature of mind-body interaction in a systems model, dietary influences, stress influences had really progressed. But the actual practices, the meditative disciplines that modify the mind-body interaction had not changed in thousands of years. So there was really nothing new to say about the meditative and mind-body practices that was new, except for the fact the science had finally caught up with the experiential part of our lives.
Well, I'd like to segue a little bit from there, and I don't want to skip over some critical parts of history here, but I'd like the listeners to know about how these observations and communications that you brought to the field translate into some of the things that you have focused on to make them implementable and executable. And I'm just going to cite a few of your earlier PubMed publications because I think it gives a little bit of a tapestry as to where you've taken these observations. So paper entitled A Wake-Up Call for Corporate America, paper entitled Mind-Body Medicine and Ambulatory Care and Evidence-Based Assessment, paper Population Health Management as a Strategy for the Creation of Optimal Healing Environments and Work Sites and Corporate Settings, a paper on developing self-reporting outcome measures for complementary and alternative medicine, care management, program evaluation, constituents, conflicts, and moves towards standardization, review and analysis of the clinical cost-effectiveness studies of comprehensive health promotion and disease prevention, management programs in the worksite from 2000 to 2004. I'm just touching on the surface here just to give a little bit of a vignette as to how you've taken this information into implementable, executable strategy. And it's interesting, through the years, you've, I know, worked with all sorts of major Fortune 100 companies, including Cisco and IBM and American Airlines and Prudential and Dow and Disney and Mercer and Merck and Pepsi and Ford and Pfizer and Walgreens and Microsoft and NASA, Blue Cross, United Healthcare. Tell me how you bridge these gaps. This is a pretty amazing domain to have impact in.
Yeah. Well, it is, and it's interesting to think about that progression initially from those first studies and demonstrations around mind-body and how we could influence and self-regulate our autonomic nervous system. What I began to think about is how often does that occur out of awareness, i.e. we create states of illness through decisions, through beliefs, through actions, through lifestyle changes that are dysfunctional, that are negative for us and create poor conditions for health. So that took me down the clinical path. But the other question, as part of the mind is healer, mind is slayer, the mind is healer part always interested me more, which are, what are the preconditions for health? How do we experience optimal health? And as I looked at that, a light bulb went off. In 1980, actually, Bob Beck, who was the senior vice president at IBM, convened a group of five of us that were supposedly experts in preventive medicine. There really weren't any experts, but we were the closest, I think, that he found. And we were going to develop the bid specifications for IBM's first health program for their total population of employees. It took us about 3 or 4 years of meetings to do that. And when we came up with the bid specs and put it out into the world, we found there were no vendors, there were no providers that could actually develop that program. So you mentioned Jonathan Fielding earlier. He started a company called U.S. Corporate Health Management, which was the provider of those programs for IBM. And I worked with Jonathan to develop these very first programs. That company was subsequently bought by Johnson & Johnson and became their Live for Life program, which was sold throughout the corporate world. But the light bulb that went on for me then and remains driving my interest to the present day is that if you look in our society and you ask who has a vested interest in health, it's the private corporate sector. Companies want productive, active, functional employees. They have no interest in disease. They have no interest in hospitalization and dysfunction. They really want people who are alive and healthy. And that led in 1985 when I started the Corporate Health Improvement Program, or CHIP. And Bob Beck at that point moved from IBM, became Senior Vice President of Personnel at Bank of America in San Francisco. So he invited companies that he thought would share this interest. I invited my academic colleagues, and we began a dialogue. This was at UCSF from 1985 to 1990 was the beginning of that program. And our mission since then and to the present day remains the same, which is to demonstrate the clinical and cost outcomes of health promotion and integrative medicine programs in work sites. So that's what we've done. And you mentioned some of the companies that we've worked with. CHIP is a group of 15 companies. We keep it at that level because our meetings, which are twice a year, are really as a working group. We develop projects, and they've been as short as 1 year with a mammography program. We did the first mobile mammography screening program at Levi Strauss in the early 80s. And for 10 years, we were the worksite branch for the Women's Health Initiative. So we've really covered a lot of ground over that time. But my main thrust, or the common element, is how does an individual achieve optimal health, and what is the supportive environment that motivates, incentivizes, and supports optimal health? And since we spend so much more time at work than anywhere else, including sleep, that is a logical place where I've focused my attention.
So you, in 2011, had an article published that you authored entitled Reflections on Developments in Health Promotion in the Past Quarter Century from founding members of the American Journal of Health Promotion editorial board. I think that that reflections concept is a very powerful concept with your perspective that probably is unique in of one, looking at the past, present, and the future. Could you help our listeners understand a little bit of what I would call the good, bad, and the ugly of where you think we have been, where we are, and possibly where we're going in this field, and how it can really help transform healthcare?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to begin with, if you look at the private corporate sector, about half of the total annual medical expenditure in the United States is governed by what private companies do and do not select for their benefits plans. So that's a huge financial leverage point within a medical system that is disease obsessed. I've actually referred to it in my publications as a disease management industry rather than a healthcare system. And disease management industry sounds pejorative, but it really isn't. I mean, disease is the focus of medicine. Management follows from that. And at 1/8 of the total U.S. economy, at $2.2 trillion in 2013, it's certainly an industry. So we have this disease industry out there, but when we look at the corporate sector, to me, the positive thing is that there is a potential for an industry that believes in better diet, improved nutrition, use of supplements, early detection, and exercise and nutrition, in the use of alternative practices that are evidence-based. If you can demonstrate, as we did with Ford, that a combination of chiropractic, mindfulness meditation, and acupuncture is more effective with back pain than traditional care in terms of clinical and cost outcomes, they have then implemented that model in all 12 of their on-site clinics that are devoted to back pain. So there becomes a point of leverage where you can take an idea that may or may not be acceptable as an idea, but when you demonstrate that it really works, the private corporate sector is very practical, and they'll say, that's fine. It's safe, it's efficacious, it's cost effective, we will implement that. So there's a very receptive place out there for all of your listeners, all of your people that are in this network, to be able to think about taking your clinical skills and bringing it into the work sites. There's tremendous receptivity. I think, you know, the downside has been a hue and cry that somehow these programs are intrusive, that it's Big Brother, that people are being coerced into certain ways of being and certain ways of acting. But the reality is, if you look closely, these are really based on informed choice. No one is coerced into stopping smoking or reducing their hypertension or cardiovascular risks or changing their diets. They're incentivized. They're very often given financial or recognition incentives, which motivate all of us in our lives. but they're not coerced into doing that. Most recently, there's been some press from several critics of the field saying, well, the return on investment figures are not real. And I've written 8 reviews of this literature over the last 25 years, and it is unequivocally clear that there are about 200 studies of worksite-based interventions. About half of those have been evaluated for cost outcomes, and of the cost outcome studies, only one failed to demonstrate a return on investment, and that was because they factored in the cost of a $2 million gymnasium into the cost side of the equation. So, of course, you're not going to see an effect with that much money piled up on the cost side. But they are cost-effective. They are clinically effective. If I look out into the future with the Affordable Care Act, really what's happened is it's placed more burden on the companies to begin to seriously take the role of themselves as promoting optimal health for their employees. So I think there are more opportunities for individuals, for vendors, for companies to go in and demonstrate by whatever clinical method you have, be it nutrition, exercise physiology, chiropractic, herbal medicine, demonstrating that you can make a difference in a major chronic disease that for them they would like to be rid of, both in terms of caring employees and in terms of cost. So I'm very optimistic about the future of this area. It's certainly growing very rapidly. We've had more activity and interest from companies both in the United States and abroad in the last 2 or 3 years than we've had in 26 years.
Well, that is very encouraging. And just for our listeners, to give you a couple of citations from the bibliography of Dr. Pelletier's published papers, the Ford Motor Company discussion you had, I think you included in a paper you published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine in 2010, Volume 52, page 256, entitled An Integrated Medical Intervention in a Ford Motor Company Assembly Plant. And then your most current review of the cost effectiveness was also in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine in 2011, a review and analysis of the clinical cost effectiveness studies of comprehensive health promotion and disease management programs at the worksite. And that was 2008 to 2010 review, and that was in the volume 53, page 1310 issue of 2011. So just wanted to put those citations into the mix for people that might want to follow up on them. So if we go back to ask the question why we then, with all this very positive information in this more than 3 decades, going on 4 decades of rigorous work and evaluation, why there are still outlier, I'd like to call it outlier, naysayer opinions that we see these things being written almost on a regular basis by people who have good pedigrees that are associated with good institutions who are saying all of this is bunk. It's all just a bunch of smoke and mirrors. None of this really works. It has no science. It's pixie dust. What is it that generates thinking people to come to this conclusion?
Well, it's interesting because you're right, that has occurred and it continues to occur. Part of it is sheer inertia, the unwillingness to really look at the data and to take a serious, unbiased, thoughtful look at the literature. What I have found in some of the recent critiques that I've written is that either the data is overlooked or there's clearly a lack of citation of the enormous number of studies that are available. Now, on the defense, if you will, of the critics, there is a great deal more to be done. The study designs are not as rigorous as they should be. It's very difficult to conduct a randomized clinical trial in a worksite. Some ways of getting around that is you'll intervene in one worksite and have a physically distant worksite as the control, so you have the same kinds of workers and the same kinds of issues. So there are ways to address the methodological limitations, which admittedly exist. If you look back over these 200 studies, you find that a lot of the early claims of return on investment were excessive. You had 10 to 1 and 15 to 1 and these really overblown estimates of return on investment. When you look at the more recent literature, the more rigorous studies, they look at around a 3 to 1 or 5 to 1 return on investment. So you're getting, if you will, more objective, more realistic kind of assessments that are taking place. So I think that's a variable. And the critics are correct. The methodology has not been the best. It is getting better. The last thing that I would say is that if you read, for instance, when Rand just this year published a study, and the critics seized on that and said, well, the Rand study is proving that these programs do not work. But if you look at the Rand methodology, it's terrible, the methodology by which the study was conducted. And the principal investigator has even publicly and then subsequently written up clarifications about the study saying, look, our study did not in fact disprove that these programs work. In fact, the evidence would indicate that they do, but they had extreme limitations on the size of the sample, the number of companies that they could look at, the nature of the database they received from the company. So there are some methodological flaws, if you will, in studies that are most often cited by the critics. But overall, when I look at my own analysis on usually every 2 or 3 years when I publish the review, the vast majority of studies indicate that these are both clinically and cost effective and becoming more so over time. We're learning. We're learning how to do these things better.
People in this field, these are people that have decided to walk a different path, maybe a road less traveled. They've often given up certain economic incentives. They've often taken on some degree of scrutiny from peers. It's not necessarily the easiest decision from a career path to take to move your training into what I would consider the new medicine of the 21st century. They'll often ask me, do you think I can actually make a living doing this? Because all the incentives, as you pointed out, Ken, are really for ICD-9-coded disease treatment and not really related to what I would call a systems biology approach towards health promotion. So as you've reviewed over the last 3+ decades, nearly 4 decades, do you feel that the environment is improving to incent docs to actually be in this field so they can make a living?
It is, and it's grudgingly slow. You traveled this path as well in your own career, and you know what it's like when you break outside of the normal reimbursement and compensation system to follow your own path, to make a contribution that's greater than compensation only model. But having said that, it is more possible now for integrative medicine physicians, for integrative medicine providers of all types, nursing, exercise, physiology, to actually be providers of these programs direct to the general public. Certainly the spa industry, the day spa industry, is growing phenomenally quickly. Those provide positions and entree points for services that didn't exist a few years ago. Secondly, the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona, which is where I'm a faculty member, has trained over 1,100 physicians in integrative medicine. That's a 2-year postdoctoral program in integrative medicine. So there are now 1,100, I think, with the exception of maybe 40 or 50, they're all domestic, about 40 or 50 are international. So they're out there back in clinics, in hospitals, in freestanding practices, delivering integrative medicine services and being compensated for them and being openly compensated for them by having appropriate coding of their billing. So it is possible for them. The third, to me, major development is national certification, which we have in every medical specialty. Well, in the fall of this year, in the fall of 2014, probably October, I believe, will be the first national exams that will provide national certification in integrative medicine. There are 13 of us that have been on the board developing the questions for the exams. These include Andy Weil and Tirona Lodog and Victoria Mazes and Patrick Hanaway. These are people who have had a leading role in the field already, Roberta Lee, Mimi Guarneri. So it's been a very exciting group. But the national certification will certainly help to establish the credibility of providers and credibility then in turn compensation and changes in coding will change. I take all of those as indications that the tide has not turned. The predominance of compensation is still for staying within the conventional medical model, but it is changing, and it's changing in ways that there are now many more people making a good living teaching, training, delivering programs, delivering clinical services than it's ever been up to this point in time. And it's going to continue.
Well, that is a really, really nice statement of great optimism about our future. I'd like to ask one last question. I will precede my question by saying I know there's no specific answer to this question, but you're such a great thought leader. I would be interested in how you might approach an answer. And the question goes something like this. We have a variety of individuals who are in decision-making positions within the disease care delivery system, both from the insurance side and from the health delivery side and institutional side, who are very resistive to change and feel that the system that we're now operating under is really the solution to the problem. It's just a question of providing excellence with regard to the present way that we're approaching the burden of disease. Yet when we look at the statistics on the cost-effectiveness of the system, even the most favorable observers would say that the cost-effectiveness is problematic and that we're really seeing some very distinctive trends where the global, or at least the United States economic system, could be brought to its knees just on the basis of the burden of the nature of Alzheimer's and diabetes and other chronic diseases that are so costly. So my question is, if there is this rising tide of recognition that the present system is not working, why is there then a resistance, do you feel, to something of change? Is it because we don't know how to change, or is it because that's the nature of systems that will resist change? Why is it that people will fight so hard to retain the present system when the evidence is it's not working?
You've asked a very powerful question. Just a few thoughts about it. One, with regard to the effectiveness of the current disease management industry in the United States, when you look at international health outcomes, heart disease, cancer, chronic diseases, infant mortality, homicide, et cetera, we rank 37th in the world. That is the same as Bosnia, 37th in the world. And among the top 12 post-industrial nations, we rank last or most expensive in terms of outcomes. So we are spending the most for the youngest average age population on the planet and getting the least in terms of health outcomes. So that's a given, and there's really no arguing with that. Why do we not change is because of the extraordinary vested interest and lobbying that occurs. If you look at the top 10 lobbies in Washington, D.C., in the top 10, you have the California Medical Association, the American Medical Association, the American Pharmaceutical Association, the American Hospital Association. So four of the top 10 lobbies in Washington have a common thread of business as usual, of keeping medicine as it is and as it is supposed to be. That's a lot of weight weighing against change. Now, countervailing that is the fact that we literally cannot keep going in this direction. This is a cost-inefficient model to prevent disease in the way that you're describing, to use the kinds of alternative methodologies which are frequently less costly, fewer side effects with better outcomes. The data is getting better, and that data is beginning to have an effect. For instance, just this morning, I had a conversation with the president and CEO of Parker Hannifin. It's a company in the Great Lakes area. They have had a policy for the last almost 10 years now of providing 80% compensation to an employee to seek any, literally any and all treatments, be they conventional or alternative. It's a worldwide company. It's a $13 billion manufacturing company. They want to begin to look at the outcomes. How do you collect data on how well these people are doing? What's the clinical and cost effectiveness of doing this? But that's astounding that such a company would have done this. They've seen their pharmaceutical costs go down. They've seen their chronic disease incidence go down. Hospitalizations have been decreased. Use of supplements has increased. Use of preventive services have increased. Exercise, et cetera. So they've seen by having this policy in place, now not all their employees are using it, and they do want to see more people do that, but they're having to educate. And to me, I think the bottom line is informed choice. What we really need is for every individual that looks at what they can and cannot do with his or her health to make informed choices, be it conventional or alternative or a hybrid of the two. That's why I like the integrative medicine. Integrative medicine is basically taking the best evidence-based conventional medicine and the best evidence-based alternative medicine and fusing them into one treatment methodology that's effective for the individual. That, to me, is the future, and I think we are moving toward that, partially out of economic necessity, partially because the research is getting better, and the awareness of these methods through the internet, through programs like this, is increasing people's awareness of what their options are to exercise informed choice.
Well, I can't tell you how much I feel privileged to have this conversation and also to have had our friendship and collegial relationship over the last 35 years. It's truly remarkable when you take a snapshot of a person's life, you as a Woodrow Wilson fellow back when, and see where your career track has taken you and the impact that your discoveries and explorations have had on social change. So I want to applaud what you've done. I want to say we got a lot of work ahead of us, but the voice that you've given us is a very, very optimistic and forward-looking thought that the paradigm will shift and that we're near something that I think makes really good sense in light of the new biology of the 21st century. I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us on Functional Medicine Update.
Thank you. This has been very enjoyable. It's really a pleasure to talk with you, Jeff.
So I want to thank Dr. Pelletier once again, both for the just extraordinary work that he's done over these many decades and for the very humble way in which he presents this work and effort that has gone into demonstrating with proof of concept many of the things that both he pioneered in thinking, but also that have been part of the growth and development of the model of systems biology and functional medicine and integrated health systems. You know, we're undergoing a very profound transformation right now. I would call it a revolution in thinking, and you can really see it and feel it in the last three issues of Functional Medicine Update as we've talked about these pioneers moving from James Freese to Leroy Hood and then Ken Pelletier. We're transforming the way that medical professionals are going to be trained. And in fact, it's very interesting that in the Journal of the American Medical Association just recently, in the March 19th issue of 2014, was an editorial entitled Transforming from Centers of Learning to Learning Health Systems, the Challenge of Academic Health Centers, in which the authors go on to say that academic health centers must master their prowess in the science of discovery with an equally earnest effort in translational and implementation science focused on health system improvement. This improvement is really going to come about through getting researchers to translate their discoveries more effectively over into clinical practice. And the implication for health system leaders is to find ways of integrating different disciplines more effectively into a comprehensive care model that will access this extraordinary explosion of new information that's available, not just leave it as a sidebar in some academic meeting, but really bring it into clinical practice so that patients can be treated as individuals with systems thinking. As I was reading this, I couldn't help but think, right on. This has really been the watchword of the Institute for Functional Medicine and the functional medicine movement for the last 25 or more years, is to try to find ways of accelerating the integration of this concept of systems thinking into healthcare delivery. As we've looked at the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, we start to be energized by its opportunities because it does create an opportunity for more preventive care and more patient engagement in their own health outcomes. But we, at the same breath, are very concerned about some of the implications of the ACA as it relates to maybe pinching the wrong people with more stress. I'm thinking of this editorial that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine recently. This is in the March 27th issue, 2014, in which they talk about the ACA maybe having a disproportional adverse effect on the less financially advantaged, on the poor. They go on to say that if you really look at the cost of everybody getting health care insurance to that of people that are of very low economic capability, that a no-frills monthly budget for a single adult with a child in most parts of the United States, they say, estimates to be about $1,300, $300 for food, $600 for rent, $400 for transportation, and potentially even more for child care and taxes. If you then do some simple math with that, you say, but then what happens if a person is forced to have Medicare premiums, or what's the implication if they have additional expenses that they were not burdened with before as it pertains to health care, $20, $30, $50 a month? Where's that going to come from, and what will happen? Will they just forget health care because they can't afford it, because it's a hierarchy of needs and they've got to have food and shelter before they have health care? So there are some real important questions that have been raised in this, and I think that one of the important outcomes is that if we're going to really make this new system successful, in which we're sending back more responsibility to the individual for their health,
that we need to have low-cost providers of health information. These would be like health coaches, and we need them to be more accessible so that not everything has to be addressed by a doctor or a nurse, which is a higher fee-for-service basis. We need to have health coaches that will guide and counsel and provide reinforcement for positive health behaviors. And I think that's a theme that we've all seen as we get into this form of healthcare with functional medicine. We need health extenders. We need collaboration. It's not a one-shot, one-person-fits-all needs type of situation. There are certain levels of expertise that are required for different types of interventions. And often the lower-cost health coach might be the place where the greatest improvement can be seen. So I think the concept of it's great to be engaging patients in their health. It's important to be incentivizing them to take responsibility, but it's important also not to be putting and imposing undue burden on people that can least afford to pay. We need to find the appropriate structure of a system that has different graded levels of intervention and, I guess you call it, sophistication of care to make accessible this model at all socioeconomic strata. You start looking beyond the accountable care organization. You know, everyone's talking about ACOs now and bundled payments and how this is all going to work in a reimbursement system and accountability towards fee-for-service. And this is a whole new model that's emerging. The thing that we're learning by all of this is that if you have an accountable care organization or clinic and you are imposed upon to be evidence-based, but evidence-based is built around the concept of personalization, in which each patient is an N of one of their own experience, then what is the evidence you're going to use for designing the program for that individual patient? Is it a standard of care that is for every other vanilla patient that's in that category, in which you're going to be judged in an accountable care model against some standard of identity that is just generic for a specific diagnosis? Or is it accountable care based upon evidence that is related to that patient's own narrative, their own history, their own experience? And this might sound like a philosophical highbrow discussion, but I think it's more than blue sky. I think it's a very important discussion because it really translates down to who's going to be paid for doing what and how are they going to be measured for effective outcome. If we hold standards of evidence only to that of medicine of the average of some kind of randomized clinical controlled trial, then we lose around the edges all the uniqueness of the individual. That's their own N of one experiment. And of course, this is what we heard and learned from Dr. Hood and his discussions about systems biology. It's what we learned from Dr. Fries as it relates to compression morbidity and organ reserve. And it's now what we've just heard about from Dr. Pelletier as it relates to organizational implementation of these programs. There has to be a personalization component that goes beyond just a standard of identity like a class structure intervention. So then that comes down to patient-centered medicine, which has been a specific focus of the Institute for Functional Medicine since its emergence in 1990-91. And one size does not fit all. A paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the February 26, 2014 issue about the patient-centered medical home, which then implements personalized healthcare in the ecos of the patient, ecos meaning the home of the patient. Because in the end, people live real lives. They have real lifestyles. They do real things around their own homes or wherever their living is. They don't live in institutions. They don't eat hospital food all the time. They're not controlled by therapists in an institutional setting. So they must be accountable to their own home, their own lifestyle. The construct of a patient-centered medical home personalized to that individual's need is a very powerful concept and one that is emerging to be part of this ACO, Accountable Care Organization, that's codified within the constructs of the new Affordable Care Act and how that's going to be implemented. This is a wonderful opportunity, I might say, for functional medicine. This is the front edge of where systems biology meets patient care, meets better outcomes. We just have to be able to express the narrative of the patient effectively in case records and demonstrate that the program has been personalized to the patient need, demonstrating positive outcome. Now, when you start doing that, it leads us into, let's use two examples, two big drivers. And I think these are good examples because they're so prevalent today in healthcare delivery. One is cardiovascular disease and the other is type 2 diabetes. So I'm choosing the big levers. You might say, that the standards of identity for the treatment of each of these are well codified within specific standards of practice and clinical guidelines, which are actually even more than guidelines. They're clinical mandates. So if historically a person had a certain set of cholesterol levels, particularly LDL, say, above 120 and total cholesterol above 200 and a family history of vascular disease, they would be on a specific cholesterol-modifying drug, a statin. And to not do that would be considered outside the standard of practice, and therefore you would be an outlier and be cut out from the fold and considered not doing good medicine. So these specific mandates for what's considered evidence-based good practice have guided therapeutics within cardiovascular disease. Now we are seeing a little bit of a change, aren't we? Because we have the new cardiovascular risk factor parameters that are just been published in 2013 and now starting to be implemented in 2014, which are no longer so prescriptive. They're a little bit more open for range of decision-making by the clinician. This is a very powerful philosophical transition right now, happening today in medicine, relative to how physicians of the future are going to practice. And I don't think I'm overblowing this or exaggerating, saying that philosophically, we are at a juncture of significant importance in how the future of medicine is going to evolve related to standards of practice and utilizing specific algorithms that would define how to treat a specific patient. Now, why am I saying that? Well, in the context that I just talked about earlier, the age of the personalized medical home, in the age of what Dr. Leroy Hood was talking about, which is the age of genomic medicine, N of one medicine, and in the age of what Dr. James Freese talked about starting in 1980, about compression of morbidity and preservation of organ reserve individualized to the patient, the construct of a specific algorithm that would define what an individual patient needs to do based upon a group average that defined that algorithm is contradictory. It doesn't fit together. There's something wrong here, right? They don't match up. It's not that we would totally throw away the algorithm. It might be instructive, but it's certainly not prescriptive in the age of personalization. So now we have a real conundrum, and that conundrum is going to visit every practitioner in their office with every patient and every reimbursement code and every third-party provider and every peer review. It's going to come to pass that there is a real issue here. How do you resolve this? It's not just theoretical. Now, that leads, coming back to cardiovascular disease, to these clinical practice guidelines for chronic cardiovascular disorders. And what is the roadmap for the future? Now, I'm quoting from a title of a Journal of the American Medical Association article. I'm not making this up. This comes from the March 26, 2014 issue, a discussion about what are these new guidelines and how do they differ from the previous algorithms for determining risk and need for therapy for patients with cardiovascular disease risk. And the emphasis is on the term guidelines, that these new views as to when a patient would be a candidate for statins are not prescriptive, but they're guidelines. And the clinical intelligence and wisdom of the practitioner comes to play in deciding when and when not to apply the specific guidelines to a specific patient. Did you hear what I just said? This is a major threshold change. In other words, if a licensed healthcare provider made the decision based upon their patient experience, the N of one of that patient, that it was not appropriate, even if that patient was in the algorithm to prescribe a certain kind of therapeutic, they would be in the scope of using good medical judgment based upon the fact that individuals can vary, and therefore you can't use a prescriptive algorithm for an individual patient in 100% of the cases. Now, the implications of this are kind of interesting. Let's take an example. We were told for many, many years that lowering LDL cholesterol was going to lower cardiovascular disease risk. And therefore, the total focus first was on lowering total cholesterol. Then it was on lowering LDL cholesterol. And there was this assumption that, like the limbo, the lower you could go, the better you were off, right? So people were using whatever therapeutics were accessible to drive that LDL cholesterol down to as low a number as possible. And that was the dominant thinking. That was the belief of truth. And if you didn't do that as a clinician, then you would be considered out of scope of practice. You weren't using reasonable medical judgment. And then what did we find? We find a number of interesting things the last couple of years. We found that cholesterol-binding resins that would be used along with statins in clinical trials, they would lower LDL cholesterol even more than the statin alone by putting this additional substance into the formulation. You probably all saw the ads on TV, the direct-to-consumer ads, where you were treating your genes, Uncle Bill, and you were treating your diet because you loved French fries. You remember these ads? So you get a double hit by taking this new drug that had something that would help you to prevent the diet-induced cholesterol problems by binding cholesterol and would also treat your genes that came through your family. So you had two drugs in one that give you additional benefit. And it was shown that this drug containing those two compounds, a statin and a cholesterol-binding substance, would in fact lower LDL even more effectively than the statin alone. However, what was the outcome? The outcome in these studies demonstrated that there was no additional benefit in reducing cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular accident by lowering the LDL more with these other agents. And so what was finally concluded, in fact, there's a very interesting paper that reviews this in the April 2nd issue of JAMA 2014, in which it talks about that cholesterol-binding drugs, although they're still being prescribed fairly extensively, have really never demonstrated that they will lead to an outcome of reduced cardiovascular disease. So now people are saying, well, it's more than just lowering LDL cholesterol. It's some other effect that certain statins have that lowering the surrogate marker LDL cholesterol with those statins also has another positive benefit that lowers cardiovascular disease outcome. And we don't know exactly what that is yet. We think it's something related to inflammation, that these statins lower hsCRP and they have a positive effect on vascular endothelial function by lowering monocyte and macrophage adhesion to the vascular endothelium and reducing inflammation. We think that, and they may lower LDL oxidation levels, but we don't have a complete secure mechanism. What we do know, it's not just solely lowering LDL. There are other factors that may be as or more important than lowering LDL itself. In fact, just lowering LDL may be the surrogate to another mechanism that occurs through only a specific class of therapeutics. Now, why am I making a big deal out of this? I'm making a big deal out of this because what we often think we know and we hold as truth and we bend it into some kind of a universal requirement later turns out to be actually not correct. And a lot of people who maybe thought their patients should be managed in a different way because they didn't subscribe to the same truth that other people did, are later to be found, maybe they're right. Maybe they managed those individual patients in the ways that were correct for that N of one experiment, which is that patient. So I think that what we're seeing is a very significant change in the philosophy about how to manage cardiovascular risk, and we're not just going on a certain prescriptive number like we did before and saying, with that number, you have to do the following. So these new cholesterol and blood pressure guidelines are really a perspective on a path forward that's quite remarkably different than that of the past. Emerging from these studies is a sense that the guidelines should be informational, but not dictate. They should guide, but not enforce, and support, but not restrict therapeutics for the individual patient decided by their practitioner. Let me say that again. Emerging data from these studies is that guidelines should inform but not dictate, guide but not enforce, and support but not restrict. This validation of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk factors is, to me, a very, very interesting example of how we are moving from this prescriptive medicine of class based upon a diagnosis to individualized medicine based upon what's best for that patient in a patient-centered approach. Now, the same thing holds true for type 2 diabetes. I've spent quite a bit of time on cardiovascular disease, but let's talk about diabetes. You know, we have thought that glycosylated hemoglobin is the sine qua non for measuring the success of therapy for a type 2 diabetic patient. Now we're finding that glycosylated hemoglobin has a J-shaped curve related to its assessment of relative risk to vascular adverse outcomes or adverse outcomes from diabetes. What do I mean by a J-shaped curve? The assumption, again, has been get that A1C level as low as possible. We'd like it down into the fours, if at all possible. And what has been found is that the data indicates there is a point as you get lower than 5.5%, as you go down to 5 and then lower than 5, that the relative risk of vascular events goes up, not down, and the relative risk of other kind of morbidities goes up, not down. So it's a J-shaped curve. You can't assume the lower the better. In fact, you get a below a nadir point of where optimal is, and now you start getting worse outcomes. This holds true also for LDL cholesterol. This holds true also for blood pressure. In other words, virtually every parameter that we measure has a J-shaped relationship, meaning too low is not good, too high is not good. In the right range for that patient is optimal function. And that begs the question, what is the right range for that patient? What is the functional determinant of that patient that gives them optimal opportunity for compression of morbidity and healthy outcomes? And that's what Dr. Pelletier was leading to and helping us to understand. That's what Dr. Hood was talking about with a systems biology personalization approach. And that's what was being discussed by Dr. Fries, organ reserve logic. So this glycosylated hemoglobin measurement is certainly important, but it is not the sine qua non, be all and end all for evaluating all aspects of metabolic flexibility and health. And too low may be as bad as too high in terms of health outcome. We need to have optimal regulation. This also holds true for body mass index. Oh, just a minute. What am I saying here? Am I saying that the lower the weight, the better is not true? Of course, that's what I'm saying. Again, it's a J-shaped curve. If a person has too low a BMI, say below 23, 22, there is increasing relative association with certain chronic disease incidents. So you get where you've undergone a catabolic event, you get too low a body mass index, and now you're in a less than ideal state. And in fact, the relative risk to disease is as great as those who have obesity. So it's a J-shaped curve. So this is the functional determinant of how an N-of-1 experiment called their patient should be monitored. The performance of that patient against him or herself relative to these normative guidelines. And I want to emphasize again, guidelines. So we are really witnessing an extraordinary transformation in how the patient should be evaluated, how the patient's story should be listened to, how the patient's therapeutics should be designed to be personalized to their need, and how to use guidelines as information but not prescription. This, to me, is the power of what we have learned from Dr. Fries, Dr. Hood, and now Dr. Pelletier in the application of these systems biology approaches to medicine. Hope you enjoyed this series of the last three, and we'll be heading on into our next mini-course series in July.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland, LLC. Reproduction in any form other than for personal use is prohibited.